Watch Scrolling for June 4th, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflo.
And I'm Pam Bedour.
And we are back again. It is another chapter of A Study in Scarlet, the very first Sherlock Holmes novel. This is Chapter 13, the continuation of the reminiscences of John Watson, M.D. Reminiscences is a great word.
It's a beautiful chapter title, just flows off the tongue. But you guys, how did it feel to be back with Watson and Holmes?
I was fine with it. We had our four chapters of setup, of the backstory, of how we got to this point. So I am ready to return, and the hope of this is that we're going to have the resolution of what really happened.
Hope. I get it. That's funny. Jefferson Hope is the guy that is at the center of all this. Jefferson Hope is in the clutches of Holmes and Watson and the police, and he's trying to escape and trying to get out the window, and they grab him and they take him to the police station.
Well, Jefferson Hope certainly is a Wild West type of name, isn't it?
It is now. It's certainly Jefferson Hope could have been a very British name, but now that we know him from these four chapters, he is certainly a Wild West sort of character.
Yeah, really American.
The opening of the chapter lays out that even though he did try to escape through the window, he seems to understand his situation. Our prisoner's furious resistance did not apparently indicate any ferocity in his disposition towards ourselves. For on finding himself powerless, he smiled in an affable manner and expressed his hopes that he had not hurt any of us in the scuffle. Holmes says, okay, we can untie his legs, and they take him to the police station. So it seems like he does accept his fate.
And Watson goes with them here. And this is quite a moment where Sherlock turns to Watson and says, you too, Doctor, you have taken an interest in the case and may as well stick to us. This is Watson's on the team now.
And you can feel like he's pretty excited about that, right? We've got Lestrade, we've got Gregson, the two police detectives, we've got Sherlock, the prisoner.
Well, he's got something to do now. Seems like that he's got a, you know, he went from this lazy guy at the beginning, or self-described lazy guy at the beginning of the book, to now he's got a mission in life. I mean, all of a sudden, he's got a little pep in his step.
And his medical expertise even gets called upon in this chapter. When Jefferson Hope, I love, he's like, he takes Watson's hand and puts it to his chest. Watson says, I became at once conscious of an extraordinary throbbing and commotion which was going on inside. The walls of his chest seemed to thrill and quiver as a frail building would do inside which some powerful engine was at work. In the silence of the room, I could hear a dull humming and buzzing noise which proceeded from the same source. Why, I cried, you have an aortic aneurysm.
I love that imagery. I love the imagery, the idea of our bodies as buildings and engines inside of our bodies humming away, a humming and buzzing noise. That's beautiful descriptive writing here from Doyle.
It really is. And I think it also draws upon the fact that Doyle himself was a doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also clarifies that Watson does have expertise that no one else has. So as he's becoming part of the detective team, he does have this expertise. Obviously, it's not like the needed information because Hope knows he's about to die and Watson just confirms it. But he does have his own skills and knowledge that he brings to this team, this brand new team of Watson and Holmes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a new team. This is the introduction of the team, Holmes and Watson. We know them from, you know, 120 years of reading and seeing different creations, but here they are. This is day one. This story is all about revenge. Revenge is, it's complicated in this story, isn't it?
It certainly is. And it's important that Jefferson Hope does have that aneurysm. So he knows he's very near death. So when he says, look, you can believe everything I'm going to tell you is true because I have no reason to lie. I'm about to die. We can actually see into his thought processes.
And we don't have the two dead people who can't talk on their behalf, but So, you know, Jefferson is right, right?
Well, yeah.
We get textually here what he says, but does he spill the whole rest of the story that we've been reading for the last four chapters? Or is this, where does that part of the story come into Sherlock's mind?
Let's come back to that question after we read the final chapter.
Okay, so there's still a mystery to be solved. Good.
Yeah, where does that come from?
That is an interesting observation.
For this chapter, let's talk through the elements of revenge, because I think, given all the reading we've done of Sherlock, you know, this question of revenge, who's allowed to make decisions about justice and vengeance, this is a theme that's going to come up through many of the 60 Sherlock Holmes stories, right?
Sure.
And so in Jeffress's mind, there's really no doubt that these two men, Drebber and Stangerson, are legitimate targets of his vengeance, right? He says they were guilty of the death of two human beings, a father and a daughter, and they had therefore forfeited their own lives. So in his mind, it seems pretty clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he says, I knew of their guilt though, and I determined that I should be judge, jury, and executioner all rolled into one. You'd have done the same if you have any manhood in you. If you had been in my place. What do you guys think of that statement, my friends?
I think he's pulling from the concept of being an outlaw in the far West. I mean, whether Doyle knew that or not, a person did something immoral. We had two deaths concerning it, the father and the daughter. They've chosen to live outside the law, and he is basically serving as, I don't know, the enforcer of these people who, outlaws, at that point, you're living outside society, breaking the rules of society. On some level, that person providing this vengeance, Jefferson Hope, in this point, feels that they don't have human rights. They don't have the rights to a trial. I'm going to enforce something that no one else can really know how it's, the peers are not going to be involved in this. I saw this.
That vigilante justice that we have talked about with Batman so many times, the idea that I am the law, I saw this happen, I am going to reap this punishment.
Is that the Will Arnett version, Steve?
Mm-hmm. That is the Will Arnett Lego Batman, 100%.
Absolutely.
Nailed it.
Guys, what about tying this notion to masculinity, right? You'd have done the same if you have any manhood in you. Like, he's not saying, like, this is how society should work. He's not really talking about, you know, capital punishment here. He's really talking about, like, if you're a man, this is what you do.
Well, I watched Raging Bull yesterday. I don't know if about
the you idea. Know about masculinity today.
Oh, my God. Certainly certainly a brutal film. But my point being is, I don't know if the brutal it's an interesting question. Like, he's crossed my manhood. Wow. Interesting.
That might be that out West different mentality than the London urban mentality that we'll get to in a second as well.
Well, because when you think about Sherlock, I don't think you think rampant masculinity necessarily. He's strong and a great boxer or whatever, but he doesn't present as like an uber masculine guy.
He holds hands, yeah, behind curtains.
Well, exactly. Right. And so, but he also plays judge and jury a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is his favorite game.
Using these exact same terms. And then, of course, you know, I do gender analysis for a living, so forgive me if I go too far sometimes, but this notion of like, you've killed the woman I was going to marry. There is a little traffic in women kind of reading to that. There's like, he loves her, so that's an awesome reading to it. But there's also like, that was mine. You could read that if you wanted to.
Yeah, it is certainly a part of it. But he believes he is vindicated. He has the right to do this for whatever reason, whether it be that masculinity or that property. He believes that this is the right thing to do because of the wrong that these men portrayed.
But it wasn't just that. It wasn't an act of passion that brought him 30 years later. This was a premeditated, planned out you know, when the opportunity arrived, he took advantage of it to kill them. He has a single-minded goal, and it is to punish those he felt wronged them.
And he pursued it for decades.
Correct.
And then, interestingly, so there's, I pulled out a bunch of quotes that I thought were super interesting, where he says, "There is no satisfaction in vengeance unless the offender has time to realize who it is that strikes him and why retribution has come upon him."
Mm-hmm. So he's willing to torture them.
Well, and teach them a lesson, sort of.
You know, because you're dead and now you can know your lesson.
Right. That sense of vengeance, that sense of vigilante justice, he has a moral code about it that is a little bit off because he is, you know, right before they die, telling them how bad they were. They don't have time to change their ways.
It's the outlaw code. He feels that they moved outside civilized law, and because of that, he has every right to do this. Now, whether that's really true.
And it's interesting that he even says to them, "You may consider me to be a murderer, but I hold that I am just as much an officer of justice as you are." He says to these two police officers, the private detective and the doctor. So that's really interesting because I think he protests a lot, right? He says, "Don't imagine that I intended to kill him in cold blood. It would only have been rigid justice if I had done so, but I could not bring myself to do it." So he has, over these almost 30 years of pursuing these guys, he's given this a lot of thought, and he's gone through a number of different justifications.
Yeah, he's sick.
The action he plans to take.
He's a sick man, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he keeps them in his mind, right? So as he's driving his cab, he says, "I could see old John Ferrier and sweet Lucy looking at me out of the darkness and smiling at me, just as plain as I see you all in this room." Eesh, all right.
He's haunted by the images of these people. And we got to know these characters. And Doyle wrote these characters so well that we fell in love with them. And we knew their character in the last four chapters. And yeah, there is that haunting that's happening in his mind that he has to solve this problem.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that he takes on a bunch of different roles. So as he plans the murders, and you could feel like he's pretty excited when he finds out the actual means that he's going to use. But like, he starts out as a cabbie. And when somebody drops a key to Brixton Place in his carriage, he makes a duplicate because nobody pays attention to the working guy, right? Similar to when he was a janitor at York College, someone's doing research, a prof is doing research on poisons. And so he takes some of the poison for this reason.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Wild West guy. He has to really change his own approach when he moves to London and becomes a cab driver. And I think this points to that sort of rural-urban divide that we're going to see in other home stories. "The hardest job," he says, "was to learn my way about. For I reckon that of all the mazes that ever were contrived, this city is the most confusing."
He never went to Boston. Roads in Boston. Oh, boy.
I don't know enough about London to know how the roads were originally established.
Right.
It's pretty curvy. It's pretty confusing.
But remember how his landscape was and how he got lost the night that Lucy and John were killed and taken. He actually got lost without a maze. And so I think that's sort of part of this, too.
Ah, that's an interesting catch. That in the sense that, you know, some people have a natural sense of direction and some people struggle with it, with direction.
Interesting.
So, guys, why did he use this pill as a means of murder?
I think there's a lot of evidence why he would choose that over just blood vengeance. He does want vengeance, but blood and just plain straight out murder would be not the way that he wanted to go about this. He says, "I don't want to be remembered as a common cutthroat."
Right.
He has an elegance to this plan, this 27 year long plan, that he doesn't want to just stab somebody. That's not what he wants from this.
Well, on some grand part of it, and it's not explicit right here, he wants them to suffer. It's not just to die. It's to suffer during that death.
But in that, he also gives Fate the opportunity of taking his life, because he has two pills that are identical in sight, but completely different in chemistry.
Was it a red and a blue pill? And
I'm ready for that. I am ready for this simulation to end. That's for sure.
It's all simulation.
I like how he talks about it, though. He says, "Let the high god judge between us. Choose and eat. There is death in one and life in the other. I shall take what you leave. Let us see if there is justice upon the earth or if we are ruled by chance." And I think, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways to read that. But one way is to say that despite having basically devoted his entire life to the pursuit of revenge, he wants to make sure it's the right thing, right? He wants to leave a space so that God can make a decision one way or the other.
And I'm going to point this out, a part of it too, because this is what I noticed. The two men who left the Mormon settlement to head out and go back to, winding up in London, they were certainly not practicing their religion when they left, because he went to the gin room and stuff like that. So, you know, it's really interesting that God at that point, they abandoned God, let's say, their version of it, and then all of a sudden God is going to be part of their fate. Here, take one of these pills.
That is a theme of this story, is the idea of faith and religion and belief. And yes,
like fate and faith, right? Like, how does that work? Yeah.
Yeah. So that's in there. I don't know. There is no mention of whether or not Drebber and Stangerson are still faithful to their religion or not, but they certainly don't seem to be, with Drebber being such a terrible alcoholic and a card player. So we've got a gambling thing going on here too.
And they're explicit. I mean, if you know anything about the Mormon faith, they do not drink alcohol, do not drink caffeine. And gambling certainly would be off the table too.
It's an interesting study in all of those ideas that Doyle is giving us here. 27-year-old Doyle has some really interesting views on all these big, big questions here, including the German idea of revenge.
Well, I found this super interesting because Jefferson Hope explains that at the scene of the murder, he got a nosebleed. And then he says, "I don't know what it was that put it into my head to write upon the wall with it. Perhaps it was some mischievous idea of setting the police upon a wrong track, for I felt lighthearted and cheerful. I remembered a German being found in New York with Rache written up above him, and it was argued at the time in the newspapers that the secret societies must have done it." Now, are you guys persuaded by that explanation?
Nope. I feel that was thrown in. I feel like Doyle needed to wrap up that piece of the mystery and threw that in at the last second. I don't buy that from Doyle.
So what you're suggesting, and I'm just trying to read into it, that as Doyle was writing this book, the race part was put in there. He'll say, "I'll come back and solve this later on." And then, you know, at the end of this chapter, he's like, I've got to solve it.
And, either that, or it was his first attempt at a red herring, and it's the worst red herring I've ever read. Right?
The BBC Sherlock actually does an awesome job with this. So I highly recommend the very first episode of BBC Sherlock, which is a rewriting of this story with super interesting ways. The other thing is that I feel like Holmes would have known about that German found in New York from his extensive reading of the sensational literature.
He knows all. He's clairvoyant too. So.
Yeah, I don't applaud
I didn't
Doyle
love that
for
moment.
This piece of writing. Yep. The other thing that needs to be tied up in this last piece of the story is Jefferson's accomplice. Remember, there was someone else involved in this whole conspiracy.
Yeah, and I love when Sherlock asks him, "The prisoner winked at my friend jocosely. 'I can tell my own secrets,' he said, 'but I don't get other people into trouble. I saw your advertisement and I thought it might be a plant, or it might be the ring which I wanted. My friend volunteered to go and see. I think you'll own he did it smartly. Not a doubt of that, said Holmes heartily. And that's it. They don't pursue.
That's it. Mm-hmm. So my first thought is, who is this friend that he found on the streets of London? Is this Moriarty?
I love that. I love that.
I mean, it's right there. Master of disguise, yep, who outsmarts Sherlock twice. Could it be?
I like it. What do you think, Chip?
It could be. I mean, we're basically knowing Moriarty is going to be introduced at some point in the future, and we're basically retro, you know, reviewing it. I don't know what the official term would be for it, but, you know, reading it now, knowing Moriarty as a character and has all these special skills, you know, did Doyle know of Moriarty at this time? I don't know.
But remember, when we are finally introduced to Moriarty, he is the spider who is running all of the crime in London. So there is certainly that seed that is planted very early here. It is certainly possible that Doyle had in mind a supervillain, a master villain who was going to be behind all of the crime.
Well, and in the final problem, Doyle certainly invites us to revisit every Sherlock Holmes story he's ever written, including this one, and see the threads of Moriarty's empire in those earlier stories. So I think this is there's no answer to that question, is it Moriarty? None will ever be given. But I think it's a great question to pose that Doyle invites himself.
This comes to an end, Pam.
Yay! Well, and this is a sort of like, this is the penultimate chapter, so the ending is pretty straightforward. The inspector rang the bell as he spoke, and Jefferson Hope was led off by a couple of warders, while my friend and I made our way out of the station and took a cab back to Baker Street, which ushers in the very final chapter of this novel.
The final chapter.
Yes.
Of book one.
The first book of the introduction. Of the introduction of this ongoing character whom we are still studying 120 years later. And it brings us to our question for the audience. We want to know, what is your favorite introduction of an ongoing character? This is a pretty good first episode of Sherlock Holmes. We're still talking about it in the future here. What's your favorite first story from a character who went on to be historic? We want to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes. Go to our website, sandwichesatirregularhours.com. We would love to hear your answer. We will talk about that in the wrap-up episode, which is coming up in 2 days. So get your answers in quick, folks. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam the Dog.
Where's my sandwich? What I want to talk about is what I want to think about.